Good morning or afternoon to everybody. This is Professor Nick Burnett in Communication Studies 103. I am going to be talking to you today about managing conflict in modern organizations. This is one of the second half lectures and is the way I'm recording these things, this is the last one that I've recorded. So hopefully I'm a little better in this one than I was in the very first ones that I recorded. I want to talk to you today about conflict and to give you a real, potentially different perspective on how conflict works in modern organizations. And the easiest way to do that, I think, is to start right off the bat with a definition. If you go to your first PowerPoint slide, it talks about the notion that when we're looking at conflict in modern organizations, it's important to understand that conflict is pervasive. It happens everywhere. It happens in the best managed organizations, and it happens in the worst managed organizations. It is not independently a sign that things are going wrong. It may, in fact, be a sign that things are going wonderfully right. So it's everywhere. So don't feel bad if you're involved in it, because, frankly, it's part of the way the world works. The next thing is, it's not just everywhere, but it's inevitable. It is, I would argue, impossible to manage a modern organization and not have some conflict. If you have no conflict, then you have a bunch of people who all think exactly alike, and frankly, I'm not sure that's a very productive organization to be a part of. The final thing to remember is that conflict is not a product. It is not a thing. It is, in fact, a process. It's a way of working through things. It is a communication process. And as such, you are best, it's best to think of managing conflict than trying to eliminate it. Because if you try to eliminate conflict, something that's natural, something that's part of the organization's communication processes, I think you're going to have a distorted outcome in the long run. There's a definition here by Professor Lulofs, who in fact is one of the folks who's done the most research in our area on in communication studies on conflict. And his definition, I think, is very good. He says, conflict occurs in situations in which, and then he's got three conditions that have to be met. One, people are interdependent. Now, think about that. People are interdependent. If two people, and this may be kind of an odd thing to think about, right? You think, oh, well, people have conflicts because, you know, they don't share the same position. But in fact, you have to share some things in common to have a conflict. If two people were completely independent, if their lives or what they did for their job or their departments, if they had absolutely nothing to do with one another, they would have no reason to have a conflict. There must be something over which they both depend. The second condition is that they seek different outcomes or they favor different means to the same ends. So maybe there's some disagreement over goals, or maybe the disagreement is not over the goal, but how you ultimately reach that goal. And then the third condition is that the people perceive that the other is interfering with their pursuit of scarce rewards or resources. So if there's money in the budget to expand a particular function in your business, but that money might also go to a different branch of the business, you two departments may be in competition over that money. It's a scarce reward. Sometimes the rewards are money. Sometimes the rewards are recognition. Sometimes the rewards are much less tangible. But the point is that you would not be in a conflict unless you were in some kind of competition over these resources. So something to think about, that it's actually a much more cooperative process than we might normally think. I want to talk a little bit about the cultural naturalness, for want of a better word, of conflict. The fact that it's actually built into our very culture. Perhaps not as much as other cultures. For instance, we don't do a lot of bargaining in the marketplaces. If you think about it, you don't go into Safeway and buy a gallon of milk and then engage the cashier in some bargaining process over, I know it's marked $4.25, but I'll give you $3.75. I mean, they'll think you're crazy, because there are very few instances in which we actually bargain and negotiate in this culture, as opposed to a marketplace in another country where literally every item might have a price tag that you're willing to bargain over. We'll talk a little more about negotiation and bargaining later in this particular lecture. But for now, we do have particular areas within our culture where it's normal that there's going to be conflict. So, for instance, in our legal system, the entire system is premised on this notion of an adversarial system of justice. The prosecutor presents the prosecutor's case, the state's case about why somebody may have committed, should be convicted of a crime, and then the defense defends against that case. They don't actually have to prove the innocence, but they have to prove that the prosecutor did not essentially meet their burden of proof in order to convict the defendant of a crime. The notion is that in that adversarial system where the prosecution and the defense butt heads, we have the greatest chance of truth arising about whether or not this person was actually guilty. Sometimes the system we think works pretty well, and other times the system you may not think works very well. But note, it's really defined by this adversarial situation of conflict between the prosecutor and the defense. Labor negotiations are another good example of how conflict is built into the system. Again, conflict, you don't have to think of it as a negative, and I think too many people do. They hear the term conflict, and you think, oh my God, must be avoided at all costs. But when in fact, it's a natural part of many systems. The CSU and the California Faculty Association just recently concluded a conflict in May over which there was a great deal of conflict. Some labor negotiations are not that difficult. Some places the two sides get together and they actually have pretty good agreement on what it is has to happen. But the point is, it's part of the natural system, as it is in politics, frankly, as well. It's always interesting to me to think that one of the ways that we are best determining how people will perform as president of the United States is how well they perform in the debates leading up to the election. Again, that's a conflict between the various parties. In this case, the debates have, you know, six or eight people in them. But when it gets down to the, you know, debate between the candidates from the two major parties, as we get closer to election, we see, again, the use of conflict. Again, this adversarial notion of a debate as a way of testing our candidates to see ultimately who does the best in the particular situation. For those of you who are going into business, again, there are different sources on these kind of statistics, but I think it's fairly safe to say, after having surveyed some of these, the notion is that managers, and particularly we're talking here about middle-level managers, which many of you aspire to be, or many of you may end up being, the note is that managers spend approximately 20% of their time managing conflict. Sometimes that conflict is between you and your superiors. Sometimes that conflict is between you and your subordinates. And sometimes that conflict is between subordinate and subordinate, so that you're not really involved at all except as kind of a referee and manager. 20% of your time is a lot. That's like one whole day every week. You're doing nothing productive, you think. Oh, I'm always just dealing with conflict. But in fact, managing conflict well is an important part of that manager's kind of, you know, toolkit or repertoire. And the understanding of, you know, it's going to happen. The fact that there's conflict in your department does not necessarily mean you're a bad manager. I want to get that out of your heads right away. And your superiors should understand that as well. They should understand that in modern organizations, conflict isn't even necessarily bad. And I'm going to be talking about some possible advantages to conflict. But if you think about something that's going to occupy 20% of your time as a manager, it seems to me it would be in your best interest to be able to manage that conflict well and successfully for your organization. And if I can put in a little plug here, we in fact have a course. It's Comm Studies 119, which is called Conflict Resolution. And I got to tell you, I got to believe that employers would love to see that kind of a course on somebody's resume. The fact that they have not just presentational speaking, but also the ability to resolve conflicts. There are some other courses we often suggest business people take as well. We have an entire course on intercultural communication, so that some of the issues raised, for instance, in the diversity lecture, we actually spend the entire semester talking about. It's something to think about. I'm just advertising, doing a little kind of plug here for my department. The final thing I want to talk about before I turn to the next page here is the connection between conflict and management theories. And my thinking goes something like this. Depending on the particular management theory that's being enacted in your organization, whether it's scientific management or kind of the general management theories of Fayol or something from Weber, or maybe something more contemporary, maybe it's William Weitzie, maybe it has something to do with contingency theory, maybe it's simply the human relations approach and it's kind of classically Douglas McGregor, theory X and theory Y. The point is that in those different kinds of management situations or paradigms, conflict means something different and is handled differently depending on the management theory that is dominant in the organization. In the classically managed organizations, because they were so top-down, conflict is probably seen as something to be avoided and something that's not terribly legitimate. And in fact, if you have an employee that is constantly in conflict or is constantly raising conflicts in the workplace, that's an employee that ultimately is going to run afoul of the managers and probably will be dismissed. Just because remember, when we're talking about classical management theory, we're talking about the organization as a machine. When you have a piece of the machine that's giving you trouble, you don't try and talk to it or reason with it. You get rid of it. You bring in a new part, and the machine hums along after that. So the classical management theory approach to conflict would be very different than somebody who is managing collaboratively, somebody who's operating a, say, theory Y or even theory Z organization, where because so much of what gets done is collaborative, conflict is just part of the game. And those kinds of managers understand that conflict is inevitable, that it's going to happen a lot, and that they're going to be better managers if they can learn how to manage conflict a little better. So again, some things to think about why management theories really do make a difference. I'm going to talk for a little bit about the benefits of organizational conflict. And I say this in the same way that the political scientists, when they talk about nuclear proliferation, and they say, well, you know, there are some positive things. Part of what nuclear proliferation does is it gives your little country a deterrence against other people attacking you. The fact that you might have a nuclear bomb would be a reason why other people wouldn't come after you. Nobody actually says that nuclear proliferation is a good thing, but there may be some benefits. In the same way, I'm not ready to embrace the notion that conflict is a good thing, but there may in fact be some benefits to conflict as it happens in organizations. So that's what we're going to talk about. One of the first things to remember is that conflict can be positive because in dealing with those kind of smaller, more well-contained skirmishes, those smaller instances of conflict, you may ultimately be diffusing potentially much larger, more difficult problems. Better to solve a problem when it's small than to keep deferring it and keep deferring it until it really blows up in the marketplace. And so I would argue that one of the positive reasons that you need to learn to manage conflict well is that you can solve problems before they get a lot bigger. And that just seems entirely reasonable. The next reason that conflict can be seen in some cases as positive is that when you're in conflict, it forces us to acquire new information. If you're going into a round of bargaining, information is key. Information allows you to kind of make positions and to make arguments in that kind of process that without that information you might not be able to make. When we go to, if you've ever gone to actually negotiate for a new car, one of the things they tell you to do is to get as much information about the car and what the wholesale costs are, and to understand the buying cycles and the selling cycles within the industry, because it's possible that you'll get a better deal at the beginning of the month than you will at the end of the month, simply because of the way quotas are driven and ultimately the way they're enacted through the car dealerships. I did recently purchase a new car, and one of the things that I did to make sure that I knew whether or not I was getting a decent price is to look up on what used to be the old Kelley Blue Book, which is now online as www.kbb.com. That is a source of information not only of used cars but also new cars and what they're selling for around the country, so that when I found that my car was selling on Kelley Blue Book for about $2,000 more than the price that I was probably going to be able to negotiate with this car dealer, I was thinking I was getting a pretty good deal. But I never, you know, there is a conflict when you go into a car buying situation. The conflict, of course, is that the car seller wants to sell you a car for as much money as they possibly can, and you want to go into that situation where you want to pay the least amount of money that you possibly can. You're interdependent because you need a new car, and that salesperson has the keys to your new car. But ultimately, that conflict often forces both sides to go out and acquire new information. And it's not just on the buyer's side, right? The sellers are acquiring new information all the time. They're going out and they're surveying their customer base. They're trying to learn about what makes their kind of demographic for particular kinds of cars tick. And the result is that they do their best to gather information about their customers before you even walk in the door. The whole business of buying cars can be a very trying and difficult thing. I want to take a little side journey here just a second to offer you a couple of insights that I've had. One is, we know for sure from research that if you're a single female who is trying to buy a car, it is always better to bring a male with you, whether it's a family member or a friend. The fact is that the male doesn't even have to say anything. The presence of a male means that you're less likely to pay a higher price. They've done really extensive research in this area, and they found that single women pay the highest prices for cars, that mixed couples pay then somewhat less, and that males alone pay somewhat even less than that. So there is some research here to suggest that the most vulnerable category is women who are going by themselves to go buy cars, whether it's because the car sellers think that they can manipulate a single woman coming in the door more than a male or a mixed couple. Ultimately, that's something to think about. You know, car dealers have their own ways. They have this, it seems like a very archaic system where typically what they will do as you're negotiating a deal is, just as you're about to close the deal, what the car dealer will do, and many of you may have experienced this, they bring in what's called a closer, somebody who's, you know, said to be the assistant sales manager or the sales manager or the vice president for sales. And just as you think you've got an agreed upon price, or that the deal is done, this person comes in to throw a curveball to the situation. They let you know that there's undercoating that's available, or that they can, you know, put in window films or give you a dash cover, something that's going to alter what's going on there, and it's going to kind of throw you off because they're doing it because they know that it increases their ability to sell the car. But it's almost like the salesperson is not allowed to do anything in many car dealerships without the approval of the person in the back of the room or in the back of the offices who has the brain for the dealership. And this can often lead to some frustrations by people who try and go and buy cars. In fact, it got so frustrating for me one time. I have a good friend who negotiates commercial real estate leases. So this is a guy who really knows something about negotiations. And frankly, he's devastatingly good at his job. And so I asked him if he would be willing to go with me when I was going to buy a car for my wife. And he said he would on two conditions. Condition number one is I had to be willing to walk away. And condition number two is once he started talking and took over the negotiations, I had to shut up. Now, frankly, that was not easy for me to be able to take a back seat on these kind of things. But let's remember about what happens in these kind of negotiations. The truth is that because of the nature of our culture, there are not very many times when we actually get involved in serious negotiations. If you think about it, it's probably when you buy a car or it's probably when you buy a house. But almost all of our other purchases, we go in and we pay whatever is on the price tag. We don't negotiate for things the way we do in the way they do in other cultures, quite frankly. And so if you think about it, we have very little practice negotiating prices. The people who are the salespeople or the general manager of sales for a car dealership, they have lots and lots of practice doing this kind of process. They're very, very good at it. And the result is most times customers are at a disadvantage and there's not a heck of a lot that we can do. So, for instance, other than knowing that you should be bringing a male along with you, I have to tell you one other story because I made a solemn pledge almost 20 years ago now. When my wife and I were looking for a good used car, we went to a local dealership. Okay, I'll say it out loud. It was Roseville Toyota. And we negotiated over the course of like 6 hours. These were just brutal, long negotiations, punctuated many times by closers being brought in to try and kind of change the nature of the deal or whatever else. But we ended up buying a used Toyota Camry, and it was a car that we really liked. But over the course of the negotiations, one of the things we continually asked them is whether they had other cars on the lot in similar configurations, similar year, similar amount of miles. These were like retired fleet vehicles, so they were a year old and had about 20,000 miles on them. And they keep telling us, no, this is the only car. And that's an important issue because scarcity is an important motivating factor to buying a car. And they're telling me, oh, no, this is the only one on the lot at this price. And so we went ahead and we bought the car. Well, oddly enough, the next day in the Sacramento Bee, they advertised three other used Toyota Camrys with, very interestingly enough, identifying numbers one below and then two above the car that we bought. Those cars were on the lot at the time that we were negotiating. And they were actually offered for sale in the Sacramento Bee for several hundred dollars less than the price that we negotiated. Well, we felt like we had been treated badly. So we went back to Roseville Toyota and we pleaded with the salesperson and he gave us to the assistant sales manager and they gave us to the sales manager. And we ultimately worked our way all the way up to, I think, the general manager for the dealership at the time. And we were kind of disgusted because these people weren't hearing our complaints and we felt like we had been lied to. And we threatened the whole deal about going to the attorney general's office or, you know, the consumer safety division of the attorney general's office, and they pretty much laughed off the whole thing. And when it came right down to it, I was there sitting with the person who was either the general manager or the assistant general manager for the dealership, and I said, look, the only thing that I have here, the only thing that I can bring to you to tell you, you know, with all seriousness about how badly I feel about the way we've been treated in this deal is that I teach at the university and that I will figure out, unless you make us right on this deal, I will figure out a way to make sure that my students every year know that we've been treated badly at Roseville Toyota, and that I'm going to make sure that folks know that. And this person sitting across the desk looked me straight in the eye and said, go for it. His response to being threatened, to being used as a bad example, is that I should go for it. Well, I'll tell you what, you know, here it is 20 years later, and I'm still telling this story, and I'm still advising my friends and family and my students. I love Toyotas. I've driven Toyotas now for almost 25 years. In fact, I'm driving a brand new Camry hybrid that I absolutely love. But I'm telling people, if you're going to buy one, consider a shop other than Roseville Toyota. That was my only leverage in these negotiations, and frankly, I have stuck with it. I'm not trying to libel these people. I'm not trying to slander them. We were treated badly, and when I told this general manager, looked him in the eye, and said, if you don't make us whole, if you don't make this right, then I'm going to figure out a way to use you folks as an example of bad faith negotiation. That general manager just looked me in the eye and said, go for it. Well, here I am 20 years later, and I'm still going for it. So if you want to buy a Toyota, God bless you. I think they're great cars. But just please, don't buy them from Roseville Toyota. And I figure if I've only even cost these people one sale a year over the course of 20 years, I'm feeling lots better about life, frankly. I feel lots better about life. Okay, I'm sorry. That was my little kind of moment of transcendence. I'm going to come back now and talk about other benefits of organizational conflict. One of the benefits is that when you're competing with other groups outside of the organization, you often will feel like you're working better together as a team. And so the bullet says intergroup conflict, right? That's conflict between groups. Often promotes intra-group cohesiveness. People will tend to work better as a team if they are faced with competition from the outside. Politicians know this, leaders of foreign countries know this, that the best way to bring people together is to make sure that they have a foreign enemy to focus on. And that's been used for a very long time in national and international politics. Finally, one of the benefits of organizational conflict that's very important is that it gives us the opportunity to really measure the people that we're supervising, to measure the people in our organization, to understand who can really step up in times of crisis. If this is a really important situation, if it's a very serious conflict, you'll know the real kind of mettle of your employees. You'll know who has the real skills, who can really step in and guide an organization. You'll be able to measure the power of those folks, the strength or their abilities, and all of that can be a good thing because sometimes putting an organization under stress, you'll learn an awful lot about your employees. So again, I'm saying that I'm not embracing conflict as a management style, but I am saying that when it occurs, there are some positive things to be gained. Of course, there are negative things as well, and these are the kinds of things that worry people about organizational conflict. One of the most important things is it can lead people to avoidance behavior, that they so fear and disdain conflict that what they do is they tend to withdraw. They tend to not engage at all for fear of getting involved in conflict. And frankly, for some people, this is the way they run their lives. And frankly, my dad was one of these people. He was every car salesperson's dream because when he walked into the little local dealership, he would find the car that he thought he wanted. He would look at the sticker price, and then, God bless him, he would pay the sticker price. He was not into bargaining. He was not into negotiations. He saw that as conflict. His argument was, this is the price they want to sell the car at. If I'm willing to buy the car at that price, then I'll take it. If I'm not willing to buy the car at that price, then I'll go someplace else. He was not interested in sitting down and negotiating for a particular car for a particular price. In organizations, the equivalent situation is you've got people who don't get involved in important projects for fear that it's going to lead to conflict either outside the organization or inside the organization. And so they're simply not equipped to participate. They're not going to offer their services because they want to avoid the conflict. And that can be bad for an organization. One of the other things that can happen during conflict, one of the classic responses to conflict, is to kind of protect your own situation. And one of the ways that employees protect their own situation in an organization during conflict is they withhold information from the larger group. So let me give you an example. Years ago, my wife was involved in a company. It was essentially a sales company. And she had figured out a way to work with her customers and a way to write business under the present comp plan that allowed her to post significantly higher earnings and write more business than other people in the business, other people even in her district in going forward. And the deal was, it was just a simple way to change the way her customers thought about the contracts and what they were committing to. But I'll tell you what, during a sales contest, she was not likely to share that information with other sales reps because she was interested in winning the first prize for the sales contest. And it wasn't until after the sales contest was over that, and frankly, a sales contest that she had won, when she was willing to divulge this other information about how she had written more business from existing company, existing customers. Again, she withheld information because that is the natural thing to do. And it's one of the reasons why you want to be careful of conflict, kind of overstressing your organization. For some individuals, this is simply not the way they want to do business. They want to be in an organization that where there's less conflict, where it's managed better when it does arise. And so you may actually be losing people from your organization simply based on the fact that they don't want to go through the stress that they see that accompanies conflict. And so you have to understand how your organization deals with conflict, whether or not your managers have been well trained to kind of diffuse the situation, because it can cost you employees. At the very least, what conflict can do is that it can cause cynicism and reduced communication, and though neither of those things are very good for your organization. So there are considerable disadvantages, particularly when you're not managing conflict well. And that's why I think this is a kind of important information to understand. Now, a few lectures ago, you may have heard the name Deborah Tannen raised in the context of sexual harassment. If you haven't listened to that lecture yet, you certainly will. So let me simply introduce the notion that Deborah Tannen, T-A-N-N-E-N, is a very well-known linguistics professor from Georgetown University. She's written a number of books on the way in which men communicate with women, both in their personal lives and at work. I think her classic book related to work is Talking 9 to 5. Believe me, if you get a chance to pick this up on a used book table or by calling Amazon.com or, you know, calling by getting online and using Amazon.com, I frankly think this is a book that almost everybody going into business needs to read. One of the things that's very interesting about what Tannen does is she marries up research that happens in on college campuses, kind of laboratory research, with the experiences of men and women out there in the real world, as it were. And so part of her research methodology is she actually goes out and she interviews people in the field. One of the sections of Talking 9 to 5 deals with a concept that she calls ritual fighting. And she found this ritual fighting extremely interesting because what it does is it highlights the differences between the way in which men and women communicate at work. When we're talking about ritual fighting, if you've seen enough of those nature shows, when male animals compete for the attention of female animals, they often have rather violent confrontations. So I'm thinking of, for instance, when bighorn sheep, our male bighorn sheep, are fighting over female bighorn sheep. You see these very vicious attacks where they just go head to head with one another, making just unbelievable noise. I can't even think how much these poor animals must need Motrin when they get done. But ultimately what we're talking about is these males competing over females. Sometimes it's done with real, with great impact, and that it actually can leave one of the animals wounded. In other cases, it's done merely for display, and they would never take these kind of fights long enough or intensely enough to actually injure or permanently injure one of the animals, because that's not good for the continuation of the species, particularly. But Tannen makes the argument that, in fact, the same kind of thing happens in organizations. And the real problem is that, though it happens, men and women ascribe different meanings to these kinds of interactions. So, for instance, Tannen tells the story in her book, Talking 9 to 5, of interviewing a woman who has taken a job in a previously all-male workplace. And she said the one thing that she'd never been able to get past was the fact that in meetings, men in her department could just go head-to-head fighting tooth and nail, trying to destroy one another's ideas, trying to destroy the policy or the idea that they had brought up, and that yet after that meeting, she would hear two of these men who had previously been fighting it out, almost like these bighorn sheep, saying, "Now remember, we're playing golf tomorrow morning at 7 a.m. I got the tee time, you better be there." She simply could not understand how men could go after one another so vociferously, to be involved in such dramatic conflict, and yet still be willing to go out and play golf with one another the next day. This woman simply could not understand it. Tannen ascribes this kind of behavior and the reason that men can have these conflicts and yet still maintain interpersonal relationships, because that's the way they learn to interact. And not just at the workplace, but in other places as well. That men are somehow culturally ingrained with this notion that large conflicts are okay. She tells another story of a woman who has taken a job again in a previously all-male workplace, I think in the medical field. And this woman was getting prepared to go into a meeting where she was going to have to argue against the policy proposal of another male counterpart. And she was very hesitant to do this, and she didn't want to hurt what she saw as a growing friendship with this person, but she really was almost apologetic in the meaning that the fact that she had to bring up these arguments against this person's proposal. Well, after the meeting, and she was really dreading having to interact with this fellow whose proposal she had so thoroughly demolished in this little meeting, it turns out this fella comes roaring up to her, and she thinks, oh my God, he's going to yell at me or he's going to be upset with me. And this guy is so glad that this woman has engaged him on this policy. He's so glad that somebody has thought seriously about what it is he was proposing and had some different ideas, that he was just effusive in his praise for this woman who had just trashed him in a meeting, because she had done what he had hoped other people would do, which is to engage on the issue, to talk about it, to make good arguments about it, to even fight about it a little bit, to have some conflict about this particular thing. And this woman was amazed, frankly, that this guy would have that kind of response, because she was operating from a more feminine conversational style where you maximize relationships, where you do your best not to put the other person in a one-down position, versus a male conversational style, which speaks more to independence, which speaks more to not being put in a one-down position. Do everything you can to put your opponents in that position. And the result is that we had very different perceptions of this interaction. The woman thought, oh my God, I'm going to make an enemy here. I'm going to destroy a budding relationship. And the guy, who thought this was just the greatest thing that had ever happened, and he was so enthusiastic that, well, here's this woman, but she can take it. She can dish it out. And he was just thrilled. Ultimately, what Tannen argues is that there are these significant gender differences when it comes to conflict. And the reason that's important is if you have a male boss evaluating female subordinates, or a female boss evaluating male subordinates, and they don't understand this information, and they don't understand that often men and women come to conflict from very different places, and that it means very different things to them, there can be a significant misunderstanding about the capabilities of that employee. If a female is evaluating a male and doesn't understand these differences, she may write in an evaluation that this person is too aggressive, too combative. The reverse is that when a male is evaluating a female subordinate and he doesn't see this kind of behavior, he may argue that she's too passive, that she's not sufficiently aggressive in putting forth her point of view. And from both sides, there can be misunderstandings. So the results here are two points. One is there are, in fact, significant gender differences in the way males and females deal with conflict, and each needs to understand the others. And frankly, this is another vote for having you folks go out and buy Deborah Tannen's book, which I think is brilliant, and it's called Talking 9 to 5. And please, go out and find that. There's, I think, been a couple of different editions, but you should be able to find it for relatively little money. It's been out for quite a long time, and there are lots of used copies floating around. Let me move to another perspective on conflict, and frankly, this is an approach to dealing with conflict that has been taught in lots and lots of consulting gigs. It is a model for dealing with conflict that is very easy to talk through. The only thing I need you to do is to think real carefully and paint a picture in your mind. Now, if I can get a slide like this onto the PowerPoint slides, it will be appended to the end. But the Kilman-Thomas conflict model, K-I-L-M-A-N-N, Thomas, conflict model, asks you to imagine a graph where the horizontal or the x-axis is cooperativeness, running low to high, and the y-axis, the vertical axis, is assertiveness of the people engaged in the conflict, again raising from low to high. So if you looked at a point very close to where those two lines met, where you have low cooperation and low assertiveness, you get a strategy or a paradigm for dealing with conflict that we would call avoidance. It doesn't cooperate with the other people, and yet it also doesn't assert your kind of point of view. That's what you get from people who are simply avoiding conflict. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk through each one of the points on this graph, and talk about low versus high and high and medium for both. And I'm going to label them and then kind of move on to the advantages and disadvantages of each. So if we're talking about low cooperation and low assertiveness, that's a point on the scale kind of in the lower left-hand corner, if you can imagine. And we would label that avoidance. The advantage to this is that, frankly, sometimes avoidance is the correct strategy for dealing with conflict, because sometimes it's exactly what's needed to take the heat out of the moment. And it is often a good strategy in dealing with conflict to say to the other person, you know what, I absolutely do want to talk to you about this. This is important, but I'm not going to do it for the next 24 hours, so come see me then. And by then, people will have settled down and, you know, maybe smarter heads have prevailed and the conflict can be dealt with from a little more distance. It's not quite as white hot as it is when somebody comes roaring into your office. Of course, the disadvantage to true avoidance is that it leaves the conflict unresolved. By not dealing with it, you're not helping the situation necessarily, and it might, of course, as we've already noted, lead to a larger outbreak down the road, and that's never a good thing. Okay, so that's low cooperation, low assertiveness, you get avoidance. The next one, let's imagine low cooperation but high assertiveness. That is, you're not cooperating with other people in resolving the conflict, but you are asserting your best interests. And what you get in that situation is competition. And think of how we have solved problems about our conflicts before using competition. In a business setting, for instance, in order to establish the pecking order among salespeople, we might have a sales contest that would allow people to compete against one another to ultimately prove who the best salesperson is, and that maybe that person who is slated as the best salesperson is ultimately the person who's going to get the job of sales manager. Having a competition in that situation would not be a surprising thing. The advantages to competition is that you often get increased enthusiasm and increased energy and increased creativity when you have people involved in a competition. For instance, the Department of Energy and the Department of Defense have been having competitions for years in regards to solar vehicles. Because what they know is that if you get a bunch of university teams or folks from private industry competing with one another on the building of vehicles for space exploration or to simply perfect solar panels on cars or having a better and more efficient solar energy engine, that one of the ways to do this is to put these folks in competition with one another. Now, unfortunately, there are also disadvantages to just using competition to solve a problem. You know, if the people feel strongly about what they're competing over, you may find that you get sabotage, that you get people trying to kind of do one another in. You may be driving opponents underground, that instead of having a free and fair competition out in the open where everybody can see it, you have folks who kind of go underground and try and do in the other person. It might also lead to violence. I mean, that's something that you have to consider. If whatever is being competed over is extremely important, you know, and you hear the stories all the time about pre-med students being very, very competitive because getting the A in the class is really important to them so that they can get into the best medical school. And there have been stories, for instance, of medical students or pre-med students who have actually sabotaged each other's lab projects in order to make sure that they get the A in the class. So competition, not without its concerns. It can give you increased creativity and increased enthusiasm, but ultimately there are disadvantages as well. And on the Kilman-Thomas model, that would be low on cooperation, yet high in assertiveness. The next one on Kilman and Thomas, and the next strategy, is called compromise. And this is for people who have kind of moderate levels of cooperation and assertiveness. So if you're looking at a graph, this would kind of be somewhere in the middle. Compromise, the advantage is this often resolves the conflict, right? If you get two people to agree that this is the way things should be done and each side gives a little bit, it may completely resolve the conflict. So it can be a very strong approach to taking care of conflict. The disadvantage, though, is that sometimes the policy that's agreed to or the decision that is made as a result of a compromise may actually be bad policy. It may actually be a bad decision. And that really, because you're not staying true to either side's vision, it may be a decision that ultimately doesn't satisfy either party very well and the conflict may continue. There are times, frankly, when there are bad ideas in organizations. There are ideas that come out of departments that need to be crushed because they're wrong for the overall good of the organization. And so simply to say, well, I have these two competing policies, and the way to resolve this is to simply have a compromise between the two, is not necessarily the best way to go. Sometimes a manager has to say, you know what, that's bad for the company, we can't do it that way. And therefore, I'm choosing this, rather than trying to not hurt people's feelings by including some aspects of both their policies or both of their proposals. Sometimes bad ideas need to be crushed, and sometimes managers need to assert themselves. Other times, compromise can be a very effective way of resolving conflict. Now, imagine a situation where you've got high levels of cooperation, so you're out pretty far to the right on that horizontal axis, but low levels of assertiveness. You got somebody who's willing to resolve a conflict by giving in. That's high cooperation, low assertiveness. And we would label that accommodation. And remember, accommodation accommodates two C's and two M's. A-C-C-O-M-M-O-D-A-T-I-O-N. Accommodation. And the advantage to accommodation, of course, is that it often quickly resolves the conflict. If you have two people who are in conflict and one says, okay, whatever you say, that's fine, we'll do it your way, those kinds of solutions end the problem quickly, but they may lead to a longer disadvantage in the long run. Because essentially, if you have, let's say, a department leader that solves conflicts with other departments by continually giving in, by continually accommodating the other side, then they're really denying the legitimacy of the claims of one side on this conflict. And if you're the supervisor who's fighting with groups outside of your area and that you continually accommodate the other side, the people in your department are not going to see you as a good leader because they're not going to feel like their interests and their points of view are argued for or being defended, that in fact the what you do as a manager is simply lay down, is you simply, you know, abandon the fight. And sometimes those fights are worth having, and sometimes employees who feel like they're not, you know, playing a real role in the governance of an organization or in the way an organization is managed, they're going to start to feel less serious about putting forward those ideas because they know their manager is simply going to, you know, fall over on this one. So again, accommodation may work to quickly lead to a solution, but it might be detrimental to the legitimacy of the claims of one of the two participants. So again, high cooperation, low assertiveness may not be the best thing. If you imagine our graph again and going all the way up to the top on the right-hand side so that you got high levels of cooperation and high levels of assertiveness, what you've got is what Kilman and Thomas call collaboration. It is the kind of decision-making that they see as probably the best in most situations. High levels of cooperation with the other people involved and yet high levels of assertiveness for what you need or want. The advantage, they argue, is that this is the kind of decision-making, this is the resolution of conflict that is truly worthy of human beings, because it brings together your critical faculties, your abilities to work with one another and to move forward. Of course, the disadvantage of collaboration is it's tough to do, and many times you've got people who are not well trained to do it. Which means if the only style of conflict resolution that you're prepared to, you know, participate in is collaboration, you have a very kind of one-sided or narrow repertoire for dealing with these things. I know that you will hear from some folks, in fact, your textbook author included, that some of these methods of conflict resolution that are outlined by Kilman and Thomas, and remember that what we've got is collaboration, compromise, avoidance, accommodation, and competition, those five, that ultimately there's a place in the organization and there's a role for a manager to use any of these five, that though there may be some that are more worthy of us as human beings, a good manager has a repertoire of being able to use all five of these methods for resolving conflicts, because again, depending on the context, and that's a notion that we heard in the very first lecture about context being important for communication, it's also very important for understanding which method of resolving a conflict is most important. Okay, a few more issues to bring up. I wanted to talk a little bit about conflict resolution, because that's a buzz phrase that you hear around quite a bit. In fact, some of you may have gone to high schools where they had peer conflict folks trained to help students within the school resolve conflicts. Rather than having a fight in the parking lot after school, they could actually come to these little conflict resolution centers and try and resolve things. I mention it only because what's really neat about the conflict, the four-phase model of conflict resolution I'm going to speak about, is this is something that any manager should have kind of in their back pocket. It should be something they should think about as a way of resolving conflicts, particularly between peers. So if you've got two subordinates who are constantly harping on one another or involved in a major conflict, this may be something that you can use when you bring them into your office and try and resolve the conflict between the two of them. It's a four-step process. It's handled linearly. That is, you have to do step one before step two before step three. But in each case, I think you've got a very positive outcome. So, for instance, if you're going to use this model of conflict resolution, you would bring the two people into your office and you would start with an introduction. And you would be charged with a brief statement reviewing the procedures that are going to be used, the way in which this little conflict resolution meeting is going to proceed. Okay, it's important that everybody know what that is. The next stage is called explanation, and it's really a chance for each party to be heard, to state their grievances, and it's really important that the other party not interrupt, even if there are what that person feels are inaccuracies or non-objective statement of the facts. So first one side gets to explain, then without consultation, without interruption, the other side gets to explain. The next step is a clarification process in which you try to elicit from the two people involved in this meeting what it is they want, but not in terms of their positions. You know, a position is, I need to have a raise of $5 an hour. That's a position. The interest is, I now have a sick child at home is a long-term chronic illness, and the resources that I get from this particular job at this moment are not sufficient for me to take care of that kid. Okay? The interest is what's behind the position. And you want to get the people involved talking in terms of interests rather than positions, because positions can be hard and fast, but interests are where you ultimately can find common ground, where you can kind of bridge the gap between two people. So have them clarify what their situation is, and try to get them to bring out interests rather than positions. And then finally, once it's clear what each side is interested in, you can have a problem-solving phase of the conflict resolution, where you might do some brainstorming for solutions. And again, make sure that you as the third party are enforcing the rules about brainstorming, which said nobody evaluates as the brainstorming is happening. Once you were able to kind of get a list of possible solutions on board, you could eliminate the solutions that don't play well, that don't really solve the problem, which are unacceptable to one side or the other, and that allows you to perhaps find your way to a final solution that makes sense to both sides, and you've got some resolution here. And you've done it in a transparent way. You haven't simply made a decision for one person or the other. You've given each side a chance to say their piece, and sometimes that's extremely important in resolving a conflict, because some of the conflict may simply be there because people don't feel like they're being heard. And just the fact that they've been able to sit down in a quiet and calm space with their manager, with the subordinate, or a neutral third party can be an important issue in conflict resolution. As I said earlier in my lecture, that this culture really doesn't demand that we get very good at bargaining and negotiation, because we don't do it very much. Oh, there are some folks like my buddy who negotiates commercial real estate leases, who is involved in negotiation and bargaining all the time. And he's really good at it. He's the one that I brought with me to get to buy a car. And ultimately, I had to be quiet once he took over. And when the dealership said, well, we'd like you to talk to our vice president of sales, which kind of meant they were going to their closer, I turned to my buddy and I said, well, I explained to the car dealership that you've gone to your closer and now I'm going to mine. So any further discussion about this sale or this issue, you're going to have to talk to my friend here. And they were stunned. They kept looking at me like, well, what are you talking about? And I explained to them, look, you've gone to your closer. You've made your move. I've made mine. You'll now have to talk to my friend here and he'll finish the negotiations for me. They almost couldn't understand that somebody was making the same move on them that they often make move on customers. But interestingly enough, everything worked out. We did, in fact, have to walk away from the negotiations. They tried to call me. I gave them my friend's phone number and said, you don't get it still, do you? You have to talk to him now. I am no longer the agent in this kind of situation. He is. Ultimately, we got the car for a very good price, much better than I would have negotiated on my own, really. But I want to make sure that everybody is clear on some terms related to negotiation and bargaining. And so I've got a little slide there with a glossary of negotiation terms. When I'm speaking of negotiation, I'm talking about a form of communication that goes back and forth between the two parties that's designed to reach an agreement when you and the other side have some interests that are shared and others that are opposed. If you have no interests that are shared, coming to some kind of a resolution is very unlikely. There may be some interdependence between the two parties, but if they absolutely do not share interests, it's going to be extraordinarily difficult for them to come to a resolution. Bargaining is a somewhat more specific process that involves the trading of assets or positions among parties to solve problems. So, for instance, you might be in a labor negotiation, get one side to say, okay, we will give up our demand for a $5 an hour raise if the company will give up its demand that 10% of the work around here must be outsourced. That would be bargaining, to give up one thing for another. Okay? Mediation is a process when a neutral third party is introduced to work with both parties. So, for instance, in my department, should there ever arise a dispute about a grade, one of the first things we do is an informal mediation where we send the student to a professor, not the professor they got the grade from, and to kind of make sure that their position as to why they think they were graded unfairly is laid out. Then that professor goes and talks to the other professor, the professor who actually graded the student, and says, well, explain to me why you think your grade is justified. Here are some of the arguments that the student has brought forward. Then that mediator goes back and talks to the student once again and says, well, you know, here are the positions of the professor involved, the one who did the grading. I think maybe I see a way to resolve this process. If you'd be willing to accept this grade, I think the professor might be willing to change your grade to that, and that might resolve the party. That's mediation. Arbitration is like mediation, except that usually when we talk about an arbitrator, that arbitrator has the authority to impose a binding solution. They have the ability to say, okay, I've heard from both sides. Here's the way we're resolving this. And there are different kinds of arbitration, some that make, I think, more sense to me than others. One of the ones that's used in baseball, actually, is very, very interesting. It's called final offer arbitration. And it kind of works like this. Imagine a situation where you have a player who wants to be paid $25 million for 5 years. That's $5 million a year. And you have a team that wants to pay that person, let's say $16 million for 4 years. So the team is paying $4 million a year for 4 years for $16 million, but the player wants $5 million a year for 5 years for $25 million. You got a pretty big gulf there that you got to worry about overcoming. Ultimately, what final offer arbitration does is this. The arbitrator sits down with both sides and explains to them that here's how we're going to proceed. What we're going to do is you're going to write up one final offer to the other side, your last best offer. And what I'm going to do at the end is I'm not going to pick and choose from both sides. I'm going to simply decide which of the two offers, the one that comes from the team, the proposal that comes from the player, I'm going to decide which one is fairest, and I'm simply going to choose that. And so a funny thing tends to happen in these final offer arbitrations, and that is the two sides move dramatically closer together, because neither one wants to risk having the other person's or the other participant in the bargaining, their side chosen over them. And so what would happen is, well, the player might scale demands back to $20 million over 5 years, for a total of $4 million a year. Baseball team may come up to a 5 year for a little more. Ultimately, what you get is a resolution in which the arbitrator chooses the final offer that best suits the situation. And what's nice about this is it often produces more satisfaction with the outcome because it means that they moved each other closer to this kind of settlement. And so ultimately, it's a good thing, a nice way to kind of resolve things. It's called final offer arbitration, and it often can be used to good effect. Two of the terms that you really have to know when we're talking about bargaining, when we're talking about these kind of negotiation processes, are called distributive bargaining and integrative bargaining, or integrative bargaining. Distributive bargaining is win-lose bargaining, and what it says is there's a fixed pie. And whatever I win out of the pie, or you know, however much of the pie I get to eat, is pie that you don't get to eat. So if there's a pie or a pool of money, and I get 55%, you get 45%, the more that I get, the less you get. If I go up to 60%, now you only have 40%. If I go to 75%, you're left with 25%. That's called distributive or win-lose bargaining. And what that really means is you've got a situation where you have to proceed very carefully because one side is going to make out to be the loser in this because one or the other is going to win and one or the other is going to lose. Integrative bargaining is something that's recently been talked about both theoretically and in real-life negotiations, but it's a way to try and figure out how to make it a win-win for both sides. And it's not easy to do, and it takes a lot more time, and it may involve both tangible and non-tangible kinds of outcomes. It may be talking about the way business is done versus how much money people are making, but ultimately you try to look for a way that's going to ultimately benefit both sides. And I'll give you an example of that actually on the next slide. Bargaining strategies is the final title here. And really, it's some things to keep in mind as you try and work through some positions that you get into. One of the things that often happens when you're going for a job is your potential employer will ask for a copy of your salary history. And they do that because they want to know what you've been making, and they want to know what you're used to making and what your likely demand is going to be for this kind of new position. But it gives them information with very little benefit to you, ultimately. And that's why one of the things that people will often tell you is to do your best to force the opposition to make the opening bid. If you tell them what you've already been making, you've kind of opened the bidding and saying, well, my last job I was making $40,000, now I'd like to be making $45,000 or $50,000. The problem is, if you are too low in your opening bid, the other side will simply accept it and you'll never know what hit you. So if you say to your potential employer, well, I've done a lot of thinking and I really couldn't accept this job for less than $65,000, and the employer says, no problem, you've got it. Well, gee, they might have been prepared to pay you very much more than that and figure that $65,000 is a cheap out for them. So do your best to try and force the opposition to open the bidding. The next one says frequent concessions. Part of being involved in negotiations, part of being involved in bargaining, is to attempt to concede on both sides. And so when I say you should make frequent concessions, that really only means concessions if the other side is reciprocating. If the other side is also making concessions, then what you want to do is show good faith and continue the bargaining process by continuing to make these kind of small but frequent concessions in hopes that the other side will keep it up as well and you folks can get to a point where both sides can win. If it's not reciprocal, there's not good faith. If you keep lowering your offer on one side and the other side stays the same, that is not a very good situation for reciprocity and unlikely to win a result. Finally, you want to do your best to look for win-win situations, to look for that integrative solution. And among the ways that you can do this, well, there are different terms here, expanding the pie. Let's say that your little division has been allocated $10,000 for raises for the next year. You have four people working in the office. Well, one of the ways that you could allocate those raises is you could give everybody $2,500. Or maybe you could give the top producer $6,000 and then split $4,000 among the other three people in the office. But either way you do it, or any way you ultimately come out with it, people are going to feel like this is not enough money for raises. The win-win solution here would not be to simply figure out a better way to cut up the pie. It would be to make sure that you have a bigger pie, to make sure that you have more total dollars to give to people for raises. One of the ways you may do that is you might want to go back to your subordinates and say, yuck, I appreciate that you allocated $10,000, but for the good people in my group, it's simply not enough money, and I feel like I'm going to have some problems allocating this effectively, and so here's my proposal. If you'll raise the pool from $10,000 to $20,000, our unit will agree to a slightly higher quota that in the long run will make you guys a lot more money. Well, in that case, you have interests on both sides being served. You have one side making more money, and you have more business being brought in through the higher quotas. That might give you a bigger pie, and when you've got $20,000 to split among four people, that's $5,000 a piece, and not everybody would have had $5,000 raises. Of course, under the old system, they would have been only half that. Joint brainstorming is getting the competing sides together in a conflict and having them work through a brainstorming process. Again, it's really important that you, as the leader, enforce the regulations that say that there should be no negative feedback during generation of ideas, but often in joint brainstorming and with piggybacking, where you work on combining ideas creatively, you can find that you get a solution that works for both sides. The final point on the PowerPoint slides is to try what's called bridging. And bridging is involved when you identify interests that are common to both parties and figure out a way to serve those interests best, to maximize those particular interests. Get people away from their positions. We want a 5% decrease in healthcare premiums, or we need a dollar an hour raise. Those are positions. And move to the kind of broader notion of their interests. It's in the best interest of both parties that this company continue to survive. If we end up giving the kind of raises or having the kind of benefits that the employees are talking about, this company will go under, and here's why. That's going to leave you with a raise for a job that no longer exists. If the company can sell that, and if the company can say, look, we need to move more towards interest that will benefit the company in the long run, maximize the likelihood this company will be around for a long time, that will ultimately serve the interests of both sides. Okay? You have to be creative. You have to think about ways to kind of work people together towards shared interests. Those are just some bargaining strategies. As you know, there are graduate programs in labor and graduate programs that focus on issues related to arbitration and negotiation and bargaining, and they're wonderfully interesting. I know Cornell has an extremely well-received program. I'm sure there are a bunch of programs out here on the West Coast as well. But it's a very interesting kind of part of how communication happens in organizations. Again, let me just remind you that we have a class, Com Studies 119, called Conflict Resolution, that I'm sure that any employer would love to see on a resume of classes that somebody's coming into a management trainee program with. I thank you very much. This is, though this may not be the last one that you hear, this is the last lecture that I'm recording for this semester. Some of these lectures will be done again. If you have specific comments on individual lectures or on the entire podcasting program, please take the time to send me an email, because the more information and feedback we have from you folks, the better we'll be able to adjust the program to your needs and interests. And so please, I thank you for your indulgence in kind of participating in this experiment. You'll have a chance at the end of the semester to fill out a satisfaction form to figure out whether or not this is something that the Communication Studies Department should continue. But ultimately, we want to hear from you. So again, if you have specific course questions like, when is my persuasive speech, you want to communicate with your graduate assistant for that. But if you want to make a comment about the way the course has proceeded and the kind of things that might help make it better, please communicate with me. My name again is Nick Burnett, and my email address is just nburnett@csus.edu. It's all over my website. It's all over your syllabus, and you should be able to find your way to send me an email, and I would very much appreciate it. And again, I thank you for listening, because at the moment now, we're done for this semester. Thanks so much.